Welcome to the 11KBW podcast on vicarious liability, post Cox versus Ministry of Justice and Mohammed versus Morrison Supermarkets by Edward Capel. This talk was given at the 11KBW Employment Law Conference on the 16th of May 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
So I'm talking about vicarious liability. After two recent cases in the Supreme Court, Cox and the Ministry of Justice, and Mohammed and Morrison's. Lord Phillips said in another recent Supreme Court case on vicarious liability that the law of vicarious liability is on the move, so it is. In the past, probably 10 or 15 years, the courts have taken the scalpel to the doctrine of vicarious liability as we previously knew it, and changed it quite significantly. And these two cases are the most recent examples of that happening. I should say they were both decided at the same time, and they both were decided by the same panel of the Supreme Court. And they deal with two different questions in the law of vicarious liability. But first, it's helpful to just think about what vicarious liability actually is, not because everyone in this room doesn't already know the answer to that, but in terms of looking at how the courts have taken the doctrine and expanded it, it's helpful to go back to first principles. So vicarious liability is, of course, a judge-made rule of law under which one person is held liable for the tortious conduct of another. As Tony Weir put it, incapable though they may be of acting, legal persons are perfectly capable of paying, so we can make them pay for those they pay to act for them. That little quote encapsulates one of the driving forces behind vicarious liability, which is to provide those who are wronged with a remedy, because in a modern economy there are lots of people who do things on behalf of others. When vicarious liability was invented by the judges, at some point it's thought in the 16th century, it's likely that where people did things for other people, the people for whom they were doing them were individual, real people, because corporations didn't exist in the same sense that they do today. But of course now, most people are employed by large entities. The large entities themselves are not capable of doing anything in the world, as it were, of perceptible fact. They always act through agents. And so the law takes the view that where an agent does something on behalf of someone else, that someone else ought to be held liable for it. And the courts have recognised, quite frankly, that the doctrine of vicarious liability, if it can be called that, is fairly rough justice. Lord Pearce said in 1965 that vicarious liability has not grown from any very clear logical or legal principle, but from social convenience and rough justice. And Lord Dyson said in Mohammed that to search for certainty and precision in vicarious liability is to undertake a quest for a chimera. Many aspects of the law of torts are inherently imprecise. And that's, of course, right. If one thinks about reasonable foreseeability, well, what does that actually mean? One thinks about the imposition of a duty of care where it's fair, just, and reasonable to do so, well, again, what does that actually mean? It's difficult to say. So, as I've said in the paper, this is one of those areas where we as lawyers live up to the old saying that if you ask a lawyer a question, the answer is always it depends. This is precisely one of those areas. So there are two overlapping questions in dealing with the question of vicarious liability. The first of which is, what is the relationship between the individual tortfeasor and the putative defendant? And that's the question that Cox deals with. And the second is, what was the connection between the conduct of the individual and the pre-existing relationship? And the courts have always struggled rather more with the question of the intentional torts. It's rather easier to say that if somebody is carrying out their job and they do something negligently, then vicarious liability will lie. But what about if they commit an intentional tort like assault or battery, and that's what Mohammed was about? In those circumstances, very few employees are actually employed to carry out physical assaults on other people. Doormen, perhaps, have that role occasionally, but very few others. And so in those circumstances, how can one say that there is a connection of the requisite sense between the tasks which the employee is asked to carry out and what they in fact do? And Mohammed answers that question up to a point. And here's the audience participation. So the facts in Mrs. Cox's case were that she works as a catering supervisor in HMP Swansea. And in prisons, as some of you may know, not from direct experience, hopefully, prisoners often work in the kitchens, and it's considered one of the better jobs, as I understand it, to work in the kitchens, alongside people who are employed by the prison service. So Mrs. Cox supervised both employees of the Ministry of Justice and some prisoners. And on this particular occasion, they were unloading some sacks of rice, I think, and they were being carried through the kitchen into the storeroom. Somebody dropped a sack of rice. Mrs. Cox bent down to tidy it up, and a prisoner walked past her and accidentally, or at least so it said, dropped a sack of rice onto her back, and she was injured. So how many people think that the Ministry of Justice should have been vicariously liable for what the prisoner did? Show of hands. That's most people, I'd say. Well, that's good. That means you qualify to be a Supreme Court Justice, I think. And in the Morrison's case, Mr. Mohammed was a visitor to Morrison's in Small Heath in Birmingham. He went into the petrol station kiosk. He'd just filled up his car. he encountered Mr. Khan, who was the employee of Morrison's. And he said to Mr. Khan, after he'd paid for his petrol, please can I print these documents off my memory stick? And Mr. Khan said no, or rather he said no, we don't do that shit. Mr. Mohammed then retreated from the petrol station kiosk under a barrage of racial abuse from Mr. Khan, who then followed him outside onto the petrol station forecourt and punched him in the head. Mr. Mohammed got into his car and tried to drive away. Mr. Khan dragged him out of his car and gave him a beating. And at the time, his supervisor was saying to him, please stop, or words to that effect. So how many people think that Morrison should have been vicariously liable for Mr. Khan's acts? Fewer people.
Many fewer.
Okay. Well, you're wrong, I'm afraid, because Morrison's was vicariously liable.
All the Supreme Court was wrong,
but who's going to tell them that? So to go back to the first question in Cox, this is the question of what kind of relationship needs to exist. Until fairly recently, it was thought that the only type of relationship in the ordinary run of things that would give rise to vicarious liability was one of employment, as we understand employment to be. And that's, of course, not an entirely clear-cut question, as we know as employment lawyers, who counts as an employee. But nevertheless, the old cases had essentially said that where the servant is acting on behalf of his master, that's your classic situation of vicarious liability. The step forward, as it were, in this regard was taken in a case called Various Claimants and the Catholic Child Welfare Society. That was a child sexual abuse case. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that the defendant, the Catholic Child Welfare Society, was vicariously liable for sexual abuse that was carried out by religious brothers who had been placed by the society in schools. And the Child Welfare Society was not itself the employer of the brothers, but it was the body which had the power to place them in the schools. And it had been admitted that the employer was vicariously liable, and the question arose as to whether the Welfare Society was also vicariously liable. And the Supreme Court held that it was, and it spoke of relationships akin to employment. And Lord Phillips came up with five factors which he said would help in identifying where somebody, where the situation would arise, where it would be fair, just and reasonable to impose vicarious liability. And they are the five up here. So the employer is more likely to have the means to compensate the victim. That's the deep pockets principle. The tort will have been committed as a result of activity being undertaken by the employee on behalf of the employer. The employee's activity is likely to be part of the business activity. The employer, by employing the employee, will have created the risk, and the employee will, to a greater or lesser degree, have been under the control of the employer. And you'll recognise that kind of multifactorial test from the cases about who is an employee in the employment law and indeed in the tax law context. So that was what was said by Lord Phillips, and that was in 2013. That was intended to be a compendious statement of what the law then was. And we come to Cox, and Lord Reed, in the way that Supreme Court judges do when they don't agree with what a previous Supreme Court judge has said, something like, well, these five factors are very helpful, but not all of them are equally as important. And he pointed out that it can't be a principled basis for liability for saying that just because somebody is rich, they ought to bear liability. So he essentially said that the deep pockets principle is not on itself, not by itself enough. And he said it's also not a principled basis for imposing liability that an employer is insured or is likely to be insured, because employers insure themselves because they are liable. They're not liable because they are insured. And he said, well, one can restate it in this way. And he said, a relationship other than one of employment is in principle capable of giving rise to vicarious liability where harm is wrongfully done by an individual who carries on activities as an integral part of the business activities carried on by a defendant and for its benefit, rather than his activities being entirely attributable to the conduct of a recognisably independent business of his own or of a third party, and where the commission of the wrongful act is a risk created by the defendant by assigning those activities to the individual in question. And one sees there the similarity in the way in which the courts have tried to draw the line between who is an employee, who is a LIMB worker for the purposes of the Equality Act and the whistleblowing provisions and so on, and who is a self-employed contractor. So when that approach was applied to the Cox case, the Supreme Court said it was quite obvious that the Ministry of Justice was vicariously liable for what the prisoner had done, because prisoners working in the kitchen were integrated into the operation of the prison. They'd been allowed to work in the kitchens by the Ministry of Justice, and therefore the Ministry of Justice had essentially created the risk that they might do something negligent or otherwise wrongful towards somebody else. The prison service, recognising that, had given the prisoners health and safety training, which no doubt included try not to drop sacks onto the backs of your fellow workers. There was nothing that was unique about the relationship between prisoners working for the amount of pay that they get. I think they got about £1 a week or something like that. National minimum wage regulations don't apply, of course. So there was no reason to accede to the Ministry of Justice's submission that it wouldn't be fair, just and reasonable to impose vicarious liability on them for what prisoners do. And there was quite a memorable bit at the end of the case where Council for Ministry of Justice had fallen back on what all advocates do when they know they're on a losing streak, which is to say that if you decide the case in this way, then the floodgates will open, it'll be the end of the world. Lord Reed said, like the fat boy in the Pickwick Papers, council tried to make our flesh creep, but he didn't succeed. So no doubt prisoners, well, we know that prisoners are very litigious people, but the Ministry of Justice is unfortunately just going to have to suck that up, is the Supreme Court's view. So that's Cox. The second question is that addressed in Muhammad. And in a way, this is the case which in which the Supreme Court take more of a step forward in terms of expanding the scope of what vicarious liability is. And the way in which they do so, Lord Toulson gave the only substantive judgment, Lord Dyson added a short judgment, is to say, well, let's look at what vicarious liability was in the past and see whether that fits the modern, the conditions of the modern world. And Lord Toulson's view was that a lot of the old vicarious liability cases had gone wrong where they had essentially held that vicarious liability did not lie in taking up a statement of the law which was in a textbook from 1907, Salmond on Torts. In that textbook, it had been said that vicarious liability would lie either A, where there's a wrongful act authorised by the master, or B, a wrongful and unauthorised mode of doing some act authorised by the master. So again, that focuses on the question of what responsibilities the employee has. And as I said, that gives rise to a difficulty with the intentional torts, because most employees' responsibilities will not involve them committing intentional torts. In Lister and Hesley Hall in 2001, the House of Lords had sought to address this question and come up with the test, if it can be called that, that vicarious liability would lie where the act is so closely connected with the employee's employment that it would be fair and just to hold the employers vicariously liable. And there we come back to the question of looking for certainty is looking for a chimera. If all you're saying is that the test is that it's fair and just to hold the employers vicariously liable, then that's not really much of a test at all. The authors of Clark and Linzel refer to that test as being rather vague. In Dubai Aluminium and Salam, Lord Nichols said, yes, it is rather vague. It doesn't really give you much guidance as to what kind of a connection will be sufficiently close. And one of the intentions, it seems, of the Supreme Court in Muhammad was to try and paint in some of the detail as to when a connection will be sufficiently close. There are lots of little phrases thrown around in the judgment, and they're taken from various different cases that Lord Toulson looks at in his grand historical overview. So does one look at the scope of employment, the sphere of responsibility of the individual employee, the field of activities? That was a phrase that Lord Toulson felt was particularly helpful, the field of activities. Putting matters into motion. In one of the cases, Lord Justice Scarman had said that it seems to me that vicarious liability will lie where the employer has put a matter into motion and ought then to be held responsible for its consequences. Well, does that mean as soon as you employ someone, you put into motion the possibility that they might deliver a beating to one of your customers? Or asking it in a different way, what was the job on which the employee was engaged? So, in seeking to answer those questions, one could look, I suppose, at the job description of the individual. If they're a customer service representative, then that might include serving customers and being polite to them and so on. It almost certainly wouldn't include not being polite to them, discriminating against them and so on. And so one way of approaching it is to say, well, is there the possibility where somebody is interacting with a customer or a client that they may go off on what used to be called a frolic of their own, but nevertheless do so within the field of activities that has been assigned to them? And Lord Toulson tried to restate the Lister and Hesley Hall test in two sub-questions. So first, what functions or field of activities have been entrusted by the employer to the employee? Or in everyday language, what was the nature of his job? And second, then the court must decide whether there was sufficient connection between the position in which he was employed and his wrongful conduct to make it right for the employer to be held liable, which is just again saying that in every case the court will decide whether it's just or fair, just and reasonable or appropriate to hold the employer liable. Interestingly, in the case of Mohammed, as I say, the Supreme Court found that Morrison's was liable for what Mr. Khan did, essentially on the basis that there was an unbroken sequence of events, as Lord Toulson put it, from when Mr. Mohammed came in and inquired about doing his printing. Mr. Khan said no, abused him, and then followed him outside and punched him in the head and so on. And that it seemed to be suggested that that unbroken sequence of events, if he'd paused for thought perhaps, then vicarious liability would not have lain. But it was that unbroken sequence of events that gave rise to vicarious liability, not a particularly convincing justification, you might think. There was another case a few years ago in the Court of Session, which also involved a supermarket, Sainsbury's, and it was called Vicuvini and Sainsbury's. And in that case, Mr. Vicuvini had been murdered by one of his colleagues who had systematically harassed him and ultimately murdered him. A member of his family sued Sainsbury's on the basis that Sainsbury's was vicariously liable for the murder. And the Court of Session said, well, that can't possibly be right because there are no circumstances in which somebody employs a customer service representative and it could be reasonably foreseen that they would go on and murder one of their colleagues. But it seems to me that even in the case of murder, Mohammed throws that into serious doubt, because if you do have employees who are generally charged with interacting with people in circumstances where they may commit civil wrongs against them intentionally, then it may well be that you as the employer will ultimately be held vicariously liable. And since Mohammed was decided, there's been one case, or at least one reported case, which has applied the principles, and that's a case called Axon and the Ministry of Defence. That was actually a misuse of private information, breach of confidence case. The claimant was a former commanding officer of a Royal Navy ship. He was dishonourably discharged for various naughty behaviour, and he sued the MOD, alleging, amongst other things, that an employee who had leaked the story of his dishonourable discharge to the press had breached his confidence. Mr. Justice Nicholl decided that there wasn't any breach of confidence because there was no relevant duty of confidence as between the employee and Mr. Axon. But nevertheless, he went on to express a view on the question of whether, if there had been a relevant duty, then the MOD employee would have been vicariously liable. and the employee's role was in a kind of policy operations division of the MOD, and her role was to provide policy advice to the military in Iraq and advice on operations in Iraq to ministers, to the MOD, which included the MOD press office and other government departments. But she wasn't herself a press officer. She had no routine contact with newspapers or other media outlets. It was said against the MOD that she was, in some senses, an information dealer. And so the field of her activities was to handle information. A risk attendant to that was that she would leak information to the press And on that basis, the MOD ought to be held vicariously liable. And the judge said, well, she wasn't an information dealer in that sense, but nevertheless, taking the broad approach, one can see how the MOD ought to be held vicariously liable. He said, the broad approach to the nature of her job cannot stop there. She worked in a security-sensitive environment. She had developed vetting clearance, which allowed her to have access to information up to the top-secret classification, and with this came obligations. The employee had signed documentation which reminded her of her obligation to maintain confidentiality in information whose disclosure had not been authorised. For someone who occupied such a sensitive position, it is, in my judgment, appropriate to view her job as including the task to preserve that confidentiality. And so what the judge does there is to say, well, you look at generally what she was employed to do, and you say, well, you can characterise that aspect of her job as being a particular task, and that particular task was to maintain confidentiality. If she didn't, then the MOD would be vicariously liable. So that is where we've reached with vicarious liability. There will no doubt be other cases in the future. I should just say briefly to conclude, which I'm happy to say is before time, you'll know, of course, that there is a vicarious liability provision in the Equality Act. The Muhammad and Cox are not, strictly speaking, employment cases. They're obviously not statutory employment cases. The tests that they propound essentially converge with the test that the courts have held ought to apply under the Equality Act, because under the Equality Act, one is, at least in some senses, dealing with intentional torts, certainly in the case of direct discrimination and harassment. And the courts have said, in relation to discrimination, that tribunals ought to take a broad approach to what is the scope of employment for the purposes of discrimination vicarious liability. And what the courts have done in Muhammad is to say, well, the common law position is now broadly the same as that which obtains under the Equality Act. So we as employment lawyers were ahead of the game, as it were. Thank you very much.